Rudy Gadet is the only person serving time for the 2007 Italian murder of British student Meredith Kircher. Now he's spoken publicly outside a court of law for the first time, giving his version of the story.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor and retired FBI profiler, also writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, advocate and activist, founder and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, and co-creator and producer of The Case of JonBenet Ramsey.
And I'm Lisa Zimbetti. I'm the casting director for Criminal Minds, where Jim Clementi is my colleague, and I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes.
So today we're going to sort of continue on the theme of the interviews of Rudy Gadet. If you haven't listened to our last podcast about the interview that he gave in January 2016, maybe it would be a good idea to do that because we're going to sort of compare and contrast another interview that he gave. And this was an interview that he gave, well, it was supposed to be an interrogation, but it was an interview he gave on the 26th of March to the prosecutor, Mignini. It's 26th of March, 2008, in Perugia, and this was a formal interrogation, which, under the law in Italy, has to be recorded. And we'll talk a little bit later about maybe some other interrogations that weren't recorded.
Do we know if this is the first time that he has spoken to law enforcement?
No, okay. It certainly is not. Although, and some people believe it is, but clearly in the text itself, he references, as well as his attorney's reference, as well as the other attorney's reference, as well as Mignini reference, other interviews that were done. And also that he was formally questioned by a magistrate for a basically what turns out to be a preliminary hearing or a probable cause hearing. There are a number of times where in this interview, Gadet says, I have to correct something from before. And we'll talk about what might really be going on behind the scenes in those instances. So if you saw the interview that was done on Italian television by
Franca Liosini.
Yes.
Stories Madelette.
That we posted it on our Facebook page.
Yeah. And you'll see a very polished Rudy Gadet, and he is very accomplished at telling stories and recounting amazing detail and so forth. And if you go through this transcript of the interrogation of Rudy Gadet, you'll see that there are a lot of parallels in between these two interviews that were done. And they're a number of years apart, obviously, 8 years apart, but in certain instances, there's a striking resemblance between the two. Wouldn't you say, Laura?
I would. And we're going to, you know, almost word for word, and we're going to point out what those things are. But I think also in contrast, and we'll go through it almost line by line, just of the significant beats that Jim and I see within this interview. But there's also key points where he's suitably vague, where you couldn't be more vague about, right, you know, something. If you're talking about your firsthand experience, there are just things that, you know, he cannot account for. And right, then other things where he goes into so much detail of things that are superfluous and actually are just not important in, right, in this narrative. So we're pointing those out. But of course, do have a look at it yourself. And it's important probably just to say who was present at this interview. because again, that's a very interesting point. Certainly when you compare it and contrast it to the UK system and probably to the US system, he was interviewed by Mignini. He was one of the key people asking questions, but also the head of the flying squad was present,
right,
as well as Napolini, who's a chief inspector, as well as two different lawyers on behalf of Gadet at different points.
Two very expensive lawyers, I might add, who happened to travel to Germany to meet Gadet before the police from Perugia got there to arrest him and bring him back, or to start the procedures to bring him back. It's very, very questionable to me how basically a homeless, basically unemployed, homeless, itinerant guy who has fled the country he's fled Italy into the heart of Europe, and he has two very expensive lawyers who show up and represent him.
Yeah, and Biscotti was present within, Walter Biscotti was present within this interview. But the other point actually was interesting, because when they go through sort of the admin of, you know, as you do at the start of an interview, of who he is and gives his personal particulars, he does give a home address. So, you know, clearly for this purpose, he's not homeless, because he does give an address, but he also said his last occupation was as a gardener.
Yeah.
So again, we know that he's, you know,
he's a gardener, he's a caterer, he's a bartender, he's just an overall, all well-rounded guy. He's also very accomplished at basketball, apparently.
That gardening job actually was, he did have that job, but it was from the family. It was from the wealthy family who
and
were
and he lost that job.
Exactly,
if I'm not mistaken.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. Yeah. I just thought it was funny. There's a little anecdote that they called his lawyers Cookie and Nice, because they were Biscotti and Gentile or something like that. So the British press kept calling them Cookie and Nice. Anyway.
All right. So why don't we dig into this? I don't have anything right now up until page 11, because the first 10 pages for me were very just matter of fact and getting some details out of the way, except the one thing that might be in there is when he says that he does not have an alias.
That's the very first question. I stopped reading it after that, Jim. I started to read it and I was like, forget it. The very first question is, do you have any pseudonyms? He's like, no. And then, of course, he's got like five that he goes by.
What are they?
He went by Kevin, he went by the Baron. I mean, he would make up names all the time. He loved to impersonate people from South America, Americans. He's from there, he's from here, he's from there. He was constantly changing his name.
Which is something that haven't we seen, Laura, in people who are psychopathic, who are charismatic, who are pretty intelligent, and they are basically pathological liars. There's no reason for them to lie.
Right. We'd call them Walter Mitties.
Yeah.
You know, this kind of character who changes faces and is kind of a bit of a chameleon. And, you know, some of them can be harmless, and then others a lot more, you know, with an intention and a purpose to manipulate. And I think just, you know, initially when they get through sort of all the admin side to it, of setting the scene and doing all the necessary protocol, I think it is interesting. I made sort of notes of, you know, once they start getting into the account, that he uses phrases like, if I'm not mistaken, if I recall correctly, these sorts of things that are very clearly pointing me to the fact that he's probably being coached in terms of what he's saying.
Yeah, he's being very careful. And this is the residual effect of having two very high-priced lawyers prepare him for this interview or this interrogation, this quote interrogation, this air quote or inverted commas interrogation. I think Laura and I both sort of felt that the first important information that was gotten out of this quote interrogation was when Guede started to talk about his first meeting or his meetings of Amanda Knox.
Right. And, you know, the first time he talks about seeing her at Le Chic, which was the bar that she worked in on September 4th. And he just describes that it's a very short conversation and that he realizes she's from Seattle. You know, I still have my doubts that this was a very long conversation. I think this was
that
just
it occurred at all.
Exactly. Well, it could have occurred, but it could just be she's taking his order. I mean, it's as simple as a drink exchange, not sort of a whole familiarity, intimate conversation. So he places, you know, that as their initial, I know who she is or was. And then he talks on page 11 about his introduction to her and the fact that he's with the guys that live on the bottom floor of the villa. And, you know, this is his quote. He said, well, you know, I made well comments that we guys make. Yes, that I would like to, you know, excuse the term, give her one.
Yes. So what he's talking about is that he wants to have sex with her, and in a crude way. And this is what guys do. And I think it's the first behavioral indicator of what kind of person he is. And had he not said that, admitted to that, and thought it was appropriate to say something like that. So there's, in a certain sense, and you'll find this throughout the interrogation, he is unflinchingly honest about certain things. Like, he's saying things to the extent that, like, why is he even telling us that? If he's the only person on the planet who could ever say this, who even knows this at all, why is he even bothering to say it when it's sort of negative. And sometimes that's what we call leakage. They don't realize that it's bad, that it shows an inner side that he doesn't really want to reveal. But this
opinion on it is that it's absolutely leakage. And, you know, he kind of puts up this veneer, and at times he wants to come off as sophisticated and polished, as we saw in the Franco Liosini. But the real him is this guy.
Right.
And maybe he feels comfortable that it's all men that are in the room, that, you know, that he puts it out there because it's men there. But, you know, my view on it, it's completely inappropriate. Whether this is, you know, banter, boys' bravado, male bravado, just the way that he's talking is disrespectful to females, full stop. So this is a leakage part of the true self.
Right. And so there's also another aspect of leakage that comes out right after that, and that is with the prosecutor Magnini. And this is the first time, but not the last time, Magnini will comment. And in this case, when Rudy said that he wanted to give her one, according, you know, indicating to Amanda Knox, Magnini responds, "Yes, yes." Now, was that also leakage on his part? He's either indicating in that case that he agrees that that's the kind of thing that people would want to do to Amanda. And it also could be leakage that he's saying, yes, that's the kind of thing I want to hear. I want to hear that kind of stuff about Amanda, because Magnini, in his mind, as you'll see, and we'll see a lot of this throughout this interrogation.
And that was my interpretation, you know, that now he's hitting on something that is of interest to Magnini, and it's sort of the positive reinforcement. You know, of course, an interview strategy, Jim, see, you know, you and I both know that, you know, sometimes you would encourage somebody as well to talk about certain things. But I think this is absolutely now, you know, his delight that he's moved into the territory that he wants to speak about, which is Amanda. And then once he starts talking about drugs and, you know, rolling joints and, you know, Magnini seems to have this laser focus on Amanda and wanting to know, well, did she smoke and what was the effect on her? And
exactly.
This is my challenge, you know, with this. Is it an interview? Is it an interrogation? Is he a victim? Is he a witness? Is he a suspect? Because it's really very confusing that he's not being spoken to as sort of the primary. He's being used to get to a view on somebody
else. You're absolutely
else.
Right. And yes, there are interrogation strategies that we employ, but I see no evidence of an overall interrogation strategy here. Because one, the questions are being asked by multiple people. There are comments made, answers given, spin given, not only by lawyers and other investigators in the room, but also by the prosecutor asking the question. So we'll get into it more, but you're right. He says Magnini is the one that brings up Amanda with respect to smoking a joint. And he's like, Amanda as well. And it's really interesting. And now we get into like page 12. Magnini asks how Amanda was affected by smoking it. And Guede says, everyone just relaxed. And Magnini says, however, she exaggerated her smoking. She was exaggerated in her smoking. Like, where does he get that from? I mean, he made it up. And he's putting that on the record, and he's telling Guede this. So it's very interesting. And then he follows up, Magnini, by saying, and she was high.
She would regularly go downstairs to smoke. So he's also sort of implying that she is a regular drug user.
Right.
And of course, that's something that comes out, the calling of a druggie.
Right.
So you're right. It goes right on the record, and there's a steer there from Magnini. And he has it's a declaration of a clear interest in her.
Right. And whether that's, you know, been deliberately stated to Guede or not, it is implied. And this is the prosecutor who holds all the cards about what's going to happen to Guede. So it definitely is something that taints whatever. Guede says in this thing.
So at this point, Magnini has already interviewed the boys who live down here. They've already interviewed Giacomo Silenzi. And all of what Giacomo says is very similar to what he tries to get Guede to say. As far as we were all talking about the girls and how we would, you know, like to do them. And how, I mean, he's sort of leading him down a very similar road from what he got out of that other. I mean, does that seem like it would make sense?
Yeah, but it's... Yes, but totally inappropriate.
Yeah.
Completely inappropriate for a prosecutor to do that. Mm-hmm. What the prosecutor is supposed to be doing is gleaning facts from this witness and this suspect. And
it's
instead,
fact-finding. Solely fact-finding.
It should be. But instead, he's very much interpreted things and adding information to the statements and even, you know, basically corralling him into certain areas. And there's areas where it's very blatant. But here he says, and she was high, referring to Amanda Knox. And Guede says, no, she was quiet. Then later on that same page, McNeeney asks, did Meredith Kircher smoke? And Guede says, yes. But then he does what we saw him do so well in that January interview, 2016 interview. Yes, but like me, with friends, without thinking, one puff and no more. So what he's saying is, me and Meredith, to be distinguished from that druggy Amanda Knox, me and Meredith are only the kind of people who only smoke if our friends are doing it, and we'll only take one puff and no more because we're good,
sensible,
honest, wholesome, sensible people. It makes me sick. And I understand why you say that when you started reading this, you know, you saw the first lie out of his mouth and that was enough because, yeah, you're going to see lots of that. But anyway.
And that's one of the challenges. I mean, you know, when you're in the room or when you're doing this analytical work, your personal reaction can't get in the way of your professional and analytical self. So, you know, you may have a visceral reaction and say, well, that was enough for me. But actually, you know, part of what Jim C. and I do, you have to stay in it and separate out the emotion that you might feel, because actually it's the professional analysis, you know, and remaining objective and being able to see what are the things that are significant, comparing and contrasting, which is really important.
Absolutely.
And Guede is absolutely consistent in being able to qualify and caveat his own behavior and transferring and putting things onto the people that suits him, of them you know, coming under the spotlight. And I have no doubt, just, you know, as we get into this, that there's been conversations before this interview with certain qualifiers that he gives that he can only have been steered either by his own counsel or by others.
By the investigative team or the prosecutor.
Right.
And you'll see it happening in the actual interrogation, which is, again, unconscionable. It should never have happened. So the next thing I have is when McNeeney, on page 14, where he characterizes Amanda, and he says, at La Chic pub, so Amanda was something of a waitress there. In other words, he can't just say, after Guede said she was a waitress, he says she was something of a waitress. He's trying to minimize her, and it's just these little tiny digs that he will take throughout, and you'll see it not only in his questions, but in statements that he actually makes on the record, which, again, why is he doing that? He should not be doing anything like that.
Actually, just before that, there's some other interesting things just about Meredith, where Guede's already laying down, you know, that he had an interest in her and was saying that he was struck by her. And, you know, he spoke to her for the most part. And, you know, I think that's quite interesting that he's talking about Meredith and giving that context. And then McNeeney goes straight back to Amanda again and says, well, you know, what was Amanda doing? What was she doing at this time? So it kind of serves two purposes of him being able to give this context of Meredith, of that actually I did have an interest in her, laying the seeds of what's to come. But, of course, McNeeney steering it back to, and there's this confusion. Are you talking about Amanda or are you talking about Meredith? And he's saying, I'm talking about Meredith. And then McNeeney manages, well, let's get back to Amanda. What was she doing? How was she behaving? What was she reacting?
Right, and so clearly this is a fishing expedition on the part of McNeeney to get information because he wants to build a case against Amanda rather than finding out the facts and seeing where they lead him. Again, a major mistake that we see in a number of the other cases that we have talked about on Real Crime Profile, in which they end up trying to or convicting the wrong person.
Right, and you know, he says he was struck by Meredith's charm, which was interesting because they didn't really talk, you know, a huge amount, but, you know, he's still sowing that seed. And even after that, McNeeney goes back. This is another time he goes back to Amanda and asks, you know, when they went to the rugby, was Amanda there? And did Guede know the boyfriend of Amanda? So each time they get off subject, you know, and it's
because,
four or five times, right, that McNeeney goes straight back to that, which for me, you know, Guede says that he doesn't know the existence of Raffaele Sollecito.
Right.
but that's relevant because it comes back up later on.
Yeah, that's on page 15 where he first... So Mignini is the first one to introduce Raffaele Silletto, not the witness.
Yeah, and this is the first introduction right at the start here. Did you know the boyfriend? And then he names him later on in the interview.
Okay, yeah. But what's crazy is that, again, it's the prosecutor suggesting information to a witness and a suspect in a brutal murder.
Well, what is he here, though? I mean, that's
he's treated like
a witness. Is he a victim or is he a suspect? You know, he's got his lawyers present, but this is the overriding problem with this interview and how, you know, it's even admissible in terms of things that have been put into his mouth, people who've been put into the discussion. It's certainly not an interrogation because there are not follow-up questions being asked.
Not the kind that we would.
And they already have all the test results now, right? At this point, they have him.
Well, they have a lot of test results, yes. Certainly they have insurmountable evidence of Rudy's guilt in this case, and yet they're treating him like a wonderful guy. So the next thing I have is that, Raffaele is introduced. The name Raffaele is introduced by Mignini, and Guedi can't be more specific. I don't know him. Never spoke to him. Things like that. He did not know the guy existed until he came back from Germany after he was arrested and extradited to Italy. So Mignini is digging for any way to try to get him to say something else. And we'll see as this progresses how many times he does that. So on page 17, Mignini references the fact that Guedi had been questioned before a judge in what he called the GIP or a preliminary hearing. So this was certainly not the first time he was questioned, and we'll see as we move on different areas in which Guedi wants to, quote, correct the record, because now he has a better recollection, even though it's 3 months later. So when we come back, we'll talk more about things that Mignini adds to this, quote, interrogation.
Rudy spoke about his life and the murder for which he is now serving 16 years. The Ivory Coast native was a far cry from the scruffy man the press described as a drug pusher and ex-con.
So the next thing on page 21, Mignini adds, seemed like a man that didn't have a relationship, and Guedi says yes. Again, this is a suggested answer. This is exactly the kind of leading question that you do not ask in an interrogation of a witness or a suspect. You don't push them down a particular road. And what it's clearly consistent with what Mignini is doing throughout this, which is trying to tag Amanda and Raffaele to something in this crime. And it gets really outrageous. One of the things that Guedi says, though, is that he saw Meredith Kircher many times. And I want to ask Laura, to you, does that seem like maybe stalking behavior?
So it's an interesting question. I think, you know, certainly when he talks in this account about seeing Meredith for the first time and saying that he declares an interest in her, that she was charming and that, he liked her, it did make me wonder whether there was a little spark there on his behalf and actually, you know, how much of it was him wanting to see Meredith and perhaps her not being interested. But he's so suitably vague about, you know, these times, these occasions when, you know, he's seen her, which I have no doubt that he did see her. But I don't think there's a huge amount of interaction, particularly when we think about the fact normally if you are keen on someone or you're fixing up a date, the first thing you do is exchange numbers, you know, and you exchange numbers because you're texting each other and you're making that plan. And of course, that doesn't happen here. So each interaction that he describes is very vague.
And it's
inconsistent. No real discussion between either of them. He can't tell us anything that she has shared with him.
Right.
That, you know, she may have well been in the periphery or with people when he's meeting up with the guys. But I don't get a sense that there was anything certainly going on between them. But he may have had a
crush on her.
Yeah. And that may have been something that even when he went into that address, maybe he was hoping that Meredith would appear.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a difficult one to say, but of course, Mignini in this goes back to Amanda and says, well, you said this thing about wanting to give her one and is trying to establish who was it that you were interested in.
Right. I mean, it's crazy. And then, of course, Guedi says, oh, yeah, and then one of the guys who lived below her told me that he wants to give her one too. You know, so they're literally sexualizing Amanda. They're making her into, you know, sexual meat for their pleasure. This is the prosecutor who's supposed to be interrogating somebody because Meredith Kircher was brutally murdered and sexually assaulted. It's just outrageous behavior. The next thing that I have is sort of around page 25-ish, where Guede keeps referring to, or he wants to correct things. He said, I saw Meredith Kircher in one place, but it turns out I saw her in a different place, and the lawyers are coming up with pictures proving that he was here and there and not there. And so it's sort of the disappearing and appearing Meredith that here. And this is his attempt, again, to try to sort of justify and back up and prove his, quote, relationship with Meredith Kircher. And I think what he doesn't realize is that, you know, soon he will actually say something that completely contradicts all of that. And we'll get to that soon. Do you have anything to add about that?
The sense of parts of this, you know, is all just so vague and confusing. And the questions are being put to him about certain places or certain people. And it's very clear that he has very, I'll call them loose relationships with people, where he sort of, some people, he doesn't even know their names. He just calls them the Spanish guys or the Italian guys or the South American guy or the Austrian guy. You know, he doesn't really have very tangible and deep-rooted relationships. And I think that also says something about him. If he's in this locality and hanging around a lot, why is it that he doesn't really know people or they don't really know him as a person?
It could be another indicator of that whole psychopathy kind of, you know, lack of empathy for other people, not seeing them as anything but things that he could use. But also during this time, he talks about the fact that he says he gave Meredith a kiss. He gave her a kiss. And it wasn't much of a kiss. It was just a nice little kiss because he's a nice gentleman, right? But it doesn't say that she kissed him. It doesn't say we kissed. He said he gave her a kiss. And again, it's so generic that nobody can prove or disprove it, which you're going to see repeatedly in this transcript.
She's dressed as a vampire, and you know, and he does say, you know, that there were lots of people around. So again, why isn't anybody seeing this so-called kiss? So we're back at that question mark of, you know, it certainly doesn't even sound like it happened because nobody can verify that meeting, them seeing each other, or the kiss. So, you know, again, he's suitably vague around certain things.
And then the next point that I have is that the night of the first, that when he said he went to Meredith's house, that he left his house at 7:30 p.m. because the news was just starting and he knows it always starts at 7:30. And then Magnini adds that he got to Meredith's house at 7:45. It's just outrageous. You don't give a witness facts. You don't tell him this, but he's doing this over and over again. Now, whether that's to help Guede so he seems more credible because they have proof that he came by at 7:45 from a video camera, or whether it's just him trying to guide Guede along, I'm not sure. But it's...
Well, he gives a time date stamp on numerous occasions. You know, that's not the only time he offers up a time.
Right.
And, you know, again, with an interview or with, you know, ours are more interviews in the UK, but of course there's own interrogations here, you really are trying to get the sense of what we call the sequence of events. And you will get a suspect to repeat it numerous times. You will ask them the sequence backwards, because if it's the truth, you can remember whichever way that you're asked. But in this account, you do have a prosecutor who is offering up the time and the sequencing of things.
Instead of testing him
and testing the evidence, testing the facts. And that's, you know, again, even with the people, he's not pressed on people who can corroborate what he's saying. You know, on these, it was an Albanian guy. It was, you know, and this, it goes on in a ridiculous way. The Spanish guy, the Albanian guy, and there's never any names or there's never any follow-up from those who are asking the questions.
He knows people's origins pretty well, but he can't damn remember anybody's name.
The Ukrainian, the Albanian, the...
Can I ask you a question about the kiss?
Yeah.
That popped up when you said that. So he admits to kissing Meredith, But as
he claims, right.
As a prosecutor, doesn't that pop in your mind? Well, wait a minute. She was seeing somebody that was your friend. I mean, why don't they press him? Like, why are you making out with your friend's girlfriend? And wouldn't he be jealous? And wouldn't, I mean, doesn't that open up a whole other?
It does. And he said, no. Nobody ever approached Meredith like a boyfriend in an intimate way when I was around her. No. She didn't have a boyfriend.
So he covers that off. Mm. And this is, you know, there's a very deliberate covering off of certain things that would be the questions that should be asked. And again, they don't probe him around those things. But I think there are some clear beats that he is trying to hit to make. And again, I go back to that kernel of truth, that there's a kernel of truth in some of the things that he says. And then other things are just out and out lies. But the out and out lies are never tested or challenged in a robust way.
So then he goes on. And he talks about this was a great line because it's so important with respect to what McNeely did with Amanda Knox. But he said, Guede says around page 34 that, so I said to Philip I would see him later, but only in a generic way. And McNeely says, yes. Like he's agreeing that you can say, I'll see you later in a generic way. Yet when they interrogated Amanda Knox, we'll go into this later, they pounded on her repeatedly that her text to Patrick Lumumba saying see you later meant they had plans. They had definitive plans to meet that night.
Yeah, that's incredible.
That's outrageous.
That's an incredible detail.
This proof months and months, even years before McNeely would continue that story, just see proof that McNeely knows that the phrase means something generic.
Totally innocuous.
Not that they would be meeting up.
But this is a cover-off point for Guede as well. This shows that there's been discussion points before it. Because I've never seen someone just voluntarily caveat, I'll see you later. Oh, right. By the way, what I meant, I didn't mean anything by it. This is what he says. I wasn't actually going to meet him.
Right.
Why would you offer that up?
Because he's been coached, right.
It wouldn't be relevant to.
Yeah, and by the way, maybe McNeely did learn something because obviously this was after Patrick Lumumba was already released, that he says, oh, yeah, I know that. I know that stuff. I've learned my lesson.
But here's the next kernel of truth, which is about the, you know, the kebab and the drink, which, you know, he does talk about later on, that he does go into the kebab shop. And again, trying to get the time sequence is a challenge. But McNeely, when he's talking about that, yeah, for me, he's overly polite in the way that he is engaged with him. You know, of all this, I understand, or, you know, it's an overly polite interview. And I'm not sure what the purpose is of that. Sometimes you might do that to elicit, obviously, you want to get the best information out of someone, but he's not trying to get information. He's just steering him and giving him information.
Right.
But again, Guede offers up the fact he didn't have a mobile phone.
Yeah, well, and he swears up and down that he didn't have one. And that's just an important point that
he didn't have it from Milan. And why is it relevant here?
Right.
And again, you know, I still go back to, if you're going to date someone, the first thing you do is exchange numbers. And there's no exchange of numbers here. So, you know, people don't just rely on, oh, I'll see you at 8:30 or whatever the time might be. There's normally, you know, particularly with younger people in this time, you know, why aren't they exchanging messages? I mean, it's the same as he doesn't know Amanda Knox because there's no messages back and forth. There's no texting. There's no phone calls. And the same with Meredith. There's no history
of
phone calls.
He's trying to create a relationship that didn't exist after the fact. And this is also when he gets into that whole kindergarten story. It's basically him trying to justify the fact that he was actually caught trespassing and burglarizing a kindergarten. He makes up a story about a South American.
Some South American.
Yeah.
Here we go again.
Yeah, that he just happened to meet. And again, he only knows him as his country of origin, not the name. And he said that this guy worked there. And if you recall, in the interview that Rudy Guede gave in 2016, in January, he said that the wife of the South American actually is the one that worked at the kindergarten.
Correct.
But first time he said it was actually the South American who worked there.
Right.
I mean, it's just, you know, it's a deliberate story. It's a contradiction. And it just shows who Rudy Guede is. The next thing that I had just, one of the things that you'll see over and over again, that Guede claims to have very specific, exact knowledge about certain things. And then other things he's just so generic on. So he said Meredith Kircher had a brown shoulder handbag. It wasn't too big. It wasn't too small. And then he says that he can't remember the color of her jacket.
But it was a jacket, something made of cloth.
Right.
Which I thought was a very bizarre description.
Right. But that's not the case with Rafael Sollecito. So he actually met Meredith outside her apartment. They went inside together. They spent time together while she was wearing that in the light, in the well-lit room. And
he's making out with
remember,
her. It's on her while he's making out with her.
He doesn't remember the jacket, the color of the jacket, but he remembers specifically the red beret with a white stripe on the guy who attacked him
and
the cheekbones.
Logos
right.
as well.
Right. And so it's just bizarre that he wouldn't know that. He said she had light-colored jeans and black Puma shoes with pink on them. It's just another one
if
of those
I'm not
things.
Mistaken.
Yeah,
he gives his little caveats, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. And then when he actually talks about going to that fateful address where Meredith lived that night, he said Meredith was not there when he got there, but she came by and asked me what I was doing. And I said, no, I came by. This completely contradicts anything he says about there being a prearranged meeting. Why would Meredith ask him what he is doing there if she had expected him to be there? So I think it may be actually something that Meredith said to him when she was surprised
right.
by him. What are you doing?
Right.
Because he's in her apartment illegally. And so I think that's a little bit of leakage. And he said, what are you doing? No, I came by. And then he explains that he wasn't waiting very long, as if that was the reason why she asked him. But the fact that he said no, in other words, as if her question to him was of surprise. He's saying, no, I just came by to see you. And again, I think that's serious leakage of what really was going on here. And of course, McNeeny then, when he says, you know, that he got inside, he said, did you see any knives in the kitchen? And Guede says, no. And then McNeeny follows it up with, you did not look. Not, did you look around? He said, you did not look. And Guede says, no. So McNeeny is giving him an excuse for not seeing a knife in the kitchen that would then later be used to murder Meredith. Again, planting information in the mouth of a witness is just absolutely wrong.
He also uses the phrase, you know, Meredith was arriving, which puts it in the active that he's almost already in a situation and then she appears and he's questioned about that. And I think that phraseology is, it could be a translation thing, but it could equally be he is in the house and then, you know, she is arriving, gets caught. Mm. So I think there's numerous little bits of leakage.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, we have parts where he's absolutely specific and then other things that are just, I call it suitably vague, but they're the things that are really important when it comes to the sequencing
right.
of what goes on. And so the next part about, you know, him having a drink from the fridge and Meredith disappearing to her bedroom and then sort of what happens from there of Meredith then being, I think he says that she wasn't angry or a little bit, and then he switches that out and says, you know, she was a bit angry, and then she's very angry.
Right.
And she's very angry and she's complaining because money's been taken, cash that was near the bed. And so there are some things that, again, are very specific in terms of their spatial location of things that were taken, which was
right.
a lot of money. And McNeeny offers up that it was a lot of money.
Right.
And then other bits where he cannot remember the detail of it. So I think there are these kernels of truth smattered throughout, and he's trying to fit.
Right. And McNeeny always perks up when he says something about Amanda. And McNeeny wants to know the details when it has to do with Amanda, but he doesn't want to know the details when it has to do with the murder victim. It's really outrageous. So there's the whole, you know, the story about how Guede says that Meredith said that Amanda stole money from her. And then Guede said that he said, well, it could have been a burglar. So then they all checked They ran around and checked, and there's a number of things that go on. One, he says that it's that druggy speech, and Magnini again loved that because it was about Amanda. He clearly, you know, was like, tell us more about that. Guede says the doors were closed, and then right after that, Magnini says, so the bedrooms were open. I mean, he's changing the words that Guede said.
He also helpfully said in between that Meredith said she couldn't take any more of Amanda bringing guys home.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Again, just peppered in between this exchange of what went on in the burglary, a key beat that, as we know, you know, there are these alleged complaints that Meredith had tension with Amanda because she was messy because of bringing guys home. And, you know, these to me are just ticking boxes.
Yeah. Meanwhile, this is the guy who's saying that he was invited by Meredith to the home, and they started fooling around in the home. So, like, he does this constantly. He judges Amanda for smoking weed, but he was smoking weed at the same time. He judges Amanda for having sex with guys, and he's in there trying to have sex with her. It's just outrageous. Again, and then he does say that, and these are points that will come up later. We'll see this in detail later about the fact that Meredith did not drink anything or eat anything once she got home, and she did not use her cell phone. And Magnini is not happy about hearing this. And later on, you'll see why, because they're going to go back and revisit this over and over and over again. So the next thing I have is then Guede gets into this whole conversation, this whole story about them getting intimate together.
Intimate and affectionate, right. And that he wanted to get to know her.
But
which is fascinating, because then he says that she was a pretty girl and I wanted to get to know who she was, you know, and not only just as a friend. So I started to ask her about her life. And then when the attorney says, well, what did she tell you about her life? He can't answer anything.
Right.
He's got nothing to offer up other than, you know, he says that they moved on from that. And I think his exact words were, at a certain point, we moved on from that. And I spoke to her about my life. So again, it's, you know, the act of omission here that it's clearly there wasn't a conversation about Meredith's life. But what he can talk about in this narrative is his own life. So he's gone back to the things that he knows that he can talk about. And it's very vague. And this is where Magnini starts to put words in his mouth. You know, again, once they move off of this point about timings, etc. But it's complete omissions. He can't say anything about Meredith because he doesn't know. That conversation, I would opine, did not take place.
Right. And then I think one of the first major mistakes in his timeline occurs here. And it's very stunning because it's on page 50 where he totally contradicts himself about this whole doorbell ring and where Meredith was, because he said, I went to the bathroom because I had an urgent need. It was Meredith herself that told me to go to that bathroom. And in the meantime, anyway, she headed for, I don't know if she was going to her bedroom or if she also went to the bathroom. However, I presume that she went to the bathroom. Anyway, we had fondled each other, and in the moment that I had to go to the bathroom. Okay, so this is where he says that she headed off and went to either the bathroom or her bedroom. But later, he's going to say, as he was entering the bathroom, the doorbell rang and she was right there and she called through the door to see who it was. So this is a direct contradiction in his timeline. It's very important for him to say that because in his story, he heard that conversation as he was going into the bathroom. Mm-hmm. He didn't hear it after he got in there. So Meredith didn't have time to go all the way to her room or the bathroom on the other end of the apartment and come all the way back in order for that to happen. So again, you have to pay attention to details. The prosecutor should have called him out on this. Instead, he just takes it, you know, at face value.
Well, there's the section before that, which again, you know, it's on page 48, 49, just right before it, when he's pushed around what happened next in this, you know, the words that he used about getting intimate and affectionate. Magnini asks him, well, what happened next? And Guede says, well, we got closer, you know, a normal thing. It's so normal. And, you know, we were with each other. But he keeps talking about this being a natural and so normal, which to me is an interesting, it's kind of an oversell again.
Right.
Why say that so
You're
many
right.
times?
You're right.
But he talks about kissing and caressing, and then he says that, and this is direct from the transcript, that he fingered her. So the digital interference is something that he puts into the conversation. But even the way the terminology is a departure, you know, kissing yes. and intimacy and caressing to using that terminology
right.
is very jarring.
It's very crass.
It's very crass. But perhaps he's accounting for certain evidence
right.
that he understands may have been found or will be found.
Or he's been told it was found and he needs to cover for it. So, yeah, and here's the thing. I mean, we had a little bit of a discussion about epithelial cells. There were his epithelial cells found inside
her vagina,
Meredith's vagina. And the thing about epithelial cells is there are actually four different types of epithelial cells. And although the evidence that we have doesn't distinguish which type it is, I mean, you have certain types that are regular skin cells, and you have certain types that are from mucous membranes of your mouth and your sexual organs. And so those types of, they're all epithelial cells, but you need to distinguish in order to know exactly the source of those cells. So I just wanted to clear that up for all of our listeners.
Yeah, that's an important point. And so why he's saying these things, you know, and he's saying, oh, we then felt that we'd gone too far. So, you know, and he's talking about putting the brakes on it because he's this respectable and yes. caring and considerate.
What
note
nice
his
guy.
Previous language that, you know, he's not going to take advantage. But what's interesting is Mignini then jumps in and says, you know, were you interrupted? And so he interrupts the flow of Guede, which again is an absolute no-no.
You want a narrative. You want them to speak as much as possible because that's where you're going to find lies if they're going to tell you. If they're going to try to deceive you, they're going to try to do it in a way by giving brief, short answers. And when they start talking, you never interrupt them. You never guide where they're going because you might miss some really incredibly important point, or you might catch them in a lie.
Right. And he had the opportunity here. But then Guedi says that they then got dressed. And then he talks about, he was asked a question about what else they did. And he said that he had touched her breasts, but they didn't take their clothes off. But then he's asked again about, you know, what's happening with the clothes and did she take her jeans off, etc. And he basically says, no, you know, they didn't take their clothing off. But then he wanted to go to the bathroom because he had a stomach ache.
Mm.
And then he very carefully says that it's Meredith who directs him to that particular bathroom. And
right.
then you have the whole, you know, issue of him saying that as he's going into the bathroom, the doorbell rings and that he has his iPod and that's his habit that he puts his iPod on. And then they ask him about where did he have his iPod because there's no mention of that before. He says he has it in his pocket. And of course, as we saw on the interview with Franco Liosini, he then claims that he put that on and puts it on at full volume. And he listens to 2.5 songs. And at that point, he hears the scream. And then, of course, we start to get he starts to become very vague around what happens next. And this alleged male that apparently is in Meredith's room that he cannot describe, as we already discussed. But just my sort of key beats on that was that he describes him with a hat, that it was his cheekbones that left an impression on him, that he had a double chin and eyes.
Yeah. And I think this part of the interrogation, and Rudy actually at this point does give a lot of narrative. So he reveals a lot of things. And this is one of the first times where it's so clear that he says, I heard a scream. It's past tense. But then he switches to the present tense and he says, I head towards Meredith's bedroom.
Just to clarify, this is very different than the statement he gave in May 2008 as far as the whole putting on, right after the doorbell, him putting on his headphones, because in May 2008, he says that he heard Amanda and Meredith talking. He knew that they were arguing and Meredith saying, we have to talk, and Amanda replying, what's the matter? So,
yeah, because you know. His timeline got all screwed up because then in this transcript, you'll see that he says that conversation actually happened as I was entering the bathroom. So he could cover for that.
Mm-hmm.
And they go into all sorts of details, but, where he says here, like he says things like, I was in the bathroom. I couldn't tell you for how long. The music thing, I heard the scream that I heard. So that's all past tense. And then when he gets later, a little bit later, he says, I didn't think of flushing the toilet. And another thing that seemed strange, and he's talking about the past tense. But then he says, I enter right into the corridor, and I see this male figure. It's present tense. I entered the corridor. This is what people typically do when they're making up a false memory, when they're lying. Dang. And he said, I see this male figure.
They change the tense, you mean?
He was, yeah, instead of remembering.
He's having to think it
memory,
all through.
He's thinking it now. And so he's composing it. He's not thinking, oh, I have to put that in the past tense. I see.
A truism you don't have to think about is why you can say it forwards, backwards, you know, whatever part in the sequence someone's asked you the question. You don't get cognitive load from it. You can just free flow.
Right.
But he's having to think through his narrative because he's fitting things.
And he's inadvertently changing it to the present tense. At that point, I say, not I said, I say what has happened. And while saying this, I move. Not I moved. He's not recounting a historical event. He's creating something. He says, I see, I say, I move, I see, he makes. This is all present tense. And it's glaringly obvious to me that this is all completely made up by Rudy Guede.
Fabricated. I mean, and at the end, you know, he says, anyway, I presume he ran off. And this is just so fascinating when you put it in its context that you have him coming out being, you know, his account that he's startled. There's somebody in Meredith's room who's attacked her. So he's attacked his so-called, you know, someone who he wants to have a relationship with. He's threatened Guede's life. And for some reason, he doesn't see what happens next in terms of, I presume that he ran off. And then, of course, we have the notorious identification of Amanda Knox via silhouette, which is just...
Yeah, that's coming up.
Incredible.
So one of the things that he says about, Guede says about this attacker of his that that obviously he's trying to blame for the murder of Meredith Kircher, he says, the cheekbones of this person left an impression on me. And then he said they were pronounced. He also says he had a double chin, his eyes. He didn't say anything about it. He just said his eyes.
He had eyes.
And no glasses. And that seemed to upset McNeeney. And one of the lawyers asked, are you sure he had no glasses? And he said, no glasses. And then he was asked about he's talking about the knife that was used to cut his hand to attack him. And it seemed to be a scalpel. The slightest touch cut me. And McNeeney wasn't happy about that, but he switches the topic. And he said, Amanda, I mean the lady, the girl that had spoken the voice, he said, and Guede says there was nobody else, only the figure, that, and he's referring to the male who slashed at him with this thing that he presumed to be a scalpel. There weren't other people in the house. So the attorney says, well, in the previous interrogation, you fought for 4 or 5 minutes, and he said maybe that was a mistake. So, you know, again, the attorney is actually testifying for him and changing his statement.
4 or 5 minutes is a very long time.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, again, him reflecting on that, because it means that he must have seen him. When you're grappling with someone, wrestling with them, you know, 5 minutes is a very long time.
Yeah.
So to come out with this vague description, you know, is at distinct odds. So,
right.
Of course, he's trying to correct that.
And here is another, and I know you mentioned it before when we were talking about the interview from January, Lisa, but where he said, he's black. I have found a black man. I have found the guilty one. Those are his quotes. And he says this guy who McNeeney is trying to get him to say is Rafael Solecito. He's saying that this guy said these things. And that this put so much fear in him that he fled the scene. He did not call for help for Meredith, and he eventually would flee the country. But so much fear in him, so much, that he went out dancing that night.
Yeah, I mean, that's at distinct odds in terms of him saying, you know, he was just so confused, he just didn't know what to do. And then to go home, his account from then on out in terms of him leaving and going home and getting washed and cleaned up and going to the laundrette, But actually, before the before he gives that account, he talks about, and we did mention it before, about getting the towels and, you know, and going to Meredith. And
this time it's two towels, not
two
three.
Towels, yeah, and trying to write on the wall because his hands were covered in blood. You know, the AF, which is just so, you know, bizarre, such an odd thing to do for
it
one,
is.
But then to describe it. And he's clearly trying to explain away the evidence that's found, evidence.
I do think this is so bizarre that it may actually be true that she was trying to speak. But what she was probably trying to say was something very different than AF. I mean, but she said it four times, so I tried to write it on the wall, which makes absolutely no sense. It's just, I think he was trying to explain the fact that his blood, his handprint in her blood was on the wall. But I have also on page 54 where he's saying that this attacker, this male attacker with the cheekbones and the eyes.
And the double chin.
He had eyes and double chin, and he had a red beret on with a stripe. He said, "Let's go away." This is after Napolini, the other attorney, said, "Have you heard Amanda's voice again? Try to order your thoughts." In other words, he's telling him, think, you know, say something relevant here. And
he's throwing him a bone.
Well, he's trying to get him, he's trying to direct his testimony here. But what he says was that he heard gravel footsteps. And I presumed the steps of more than one person on the gravel path. Now, not only does he do a silhouette ID pretty soon, he's now created a new science of gravel footprint identification.
This is pioneering stuff.
It is. It is. So Rudy Guede has the ability to determine that it's multiple people walking on gravel from the sound of these gravel footsteps.
Recognition when he's heard a voice once and he's in a bathroom and he's got earphones on, but to be able to voice ID.
It's amazing.
Amanda Knox. So, and of course, the silhouette.
And
too,
then the silhouette ID. This is amazing. So we have three amazing, like incredibly forceful and powerful pieces of evidence that identify Amanda Knox. You got a silhouette, you got a voice through a door, and you got a multiple gravel footsteps. When we come back, we'll get into more of Rudy Guede's interrogation by Prosecutor Magnini.
According to the Daily Beast, Rudy maintained his innocence, pointing the finger at Seattle native Amanda Knox and refused to name her Italian boyfriend, Rafael Solicito. Knox and Solicito were convicted, acquitted, reconvicted, and definitively acquitted of Kircher's murder over the course of the last 8 years.
So we're back in talking about Rudy Guede's interrogation by Prosecutor Magnini. And the next point, and this is also on page 54, he said he saw the bedroom with an open window. And he thought he would go see who these multiple people were that were running across the gravel. But he didn't see multiple people, it turns out. He actually saw the silhouette of a woman. And that's as far as he goes in this particular sentence, but this will progress more as the back and forth continues.
There's so much more to talk about these transcripts. We're only like halfway through the transcript of this particular interrogation, in air quotes and inverted.
Yeah, this is definitely an inverted commas.
Yes.
Interrogation or interview.
So we have so much more to talk about. We're going to wrap it up today, and we're going to continue around page 55 with the interrogation of Rudy Guede by Prosecutor Magnini in our next edition of Real Crime Profile.
So if you enjoy our podcast and would like to support us, there are a couple of important things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and give us a positive 5-star review. You can check out our sponsors and take advantage of the special promotions for Real Crime Profile listeners. You can go over and like our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter. But most importantly, you can share our podcast with friends, family, and anyone you know would be interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. So thank you for listening.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website www.genesisshelter.org or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.
If you're a regular listener to the show, you know we have great brands like Blue Apron, Audible, and Casper advertising with us, and they keep coming back because our listeners really respond to them, which we're really thankful for. Well, if you happen to own a business or manage the advertising buy for one, then you should consider advertising on Real Crime Profile. Podcast advertising is on the rise, and it's one of the most effective ways of reaching consumers on the go today. So please go to wondery.com/advertisers. Again, it's wondery.com/advertisers. And get in touch with us. Thanks.